The World This Week. News and analysis. I'm Alan Jackson, CBS News, reporting on the CBS Radio Network. The highlight of the news this past week was the announcement that came from the White House Thursday evening that President Nixon had checked into Bethesda Naval Hospital suffering from pneumonia. But by the end of the week, there was an encouraging report from his personal physician, Dr. Walter Tkach.
Although the prognosis now is excellent, the chief concern is that the president will push himself too hard and too fast and perhaps slow down his recovery or possible cause a relapse. His treatment program remains unchanged, with chest therapy, the antibiotics, short periods of sitting at the bedside, and by the way, those are four periods during the day, and mild analgesics as necessary today. He is still a sick man, but the improvement is considered to be acceptable.
The doctor admitted that one of his problems is getting the president to rest and avoid so much of the work schedule that goes with the office, a work schedule that seems to continue even in a hospital, as Tony Sargent tells us.
Whether a president of the United States is traveling in China, vacationing in California, campaigning in Des Moines, Iowa, or recuperating from viral pneumonia in Bethesda Naval Hospital, he has such an arsenal of communications equipment traveling with him that his main function as president, that of quick decision maker, can receive the input from anyone he wants to talk with, anywhere, at any time, and his orders can be transmitted to the four corners of the earth. The presidential day-to-day duties, deliberation on paperwork and policy, can take place in the president's spacious hospital room, which includes a desk and plenty of seating space for advisors and conferees. If they overflow, there's a conference room adjoining. White House limousines shuttle back and forth from this hospital, carrying both the people and the papers that provide most of the input to the president's decision-making. There's little doubt the president has the world's toughest job, but he also has what must be the greatest amount of help, both personal and technological, to assure that he does it anywhere and under virtually any circumstances.
In the background of the hospital story is the continuing probe of the Watergate affair. Mr. Nixon has indicated that he will not appear before the committee or hand over to it any of the presidential papers involved. Committee Chairman Sam Ervin raised the possibility of voting to subpoena the papers and then leaving the next step up to the president.
If the president does not honor it, as far as I'm concerned, my own personal opinion, I don't know what the committee's attitude would be, that the committee would just simply allow the president to take the risk of adverse inferences being drawn by the American people.
But the consensus of committee members seems to be that a compromise will be worked out to avoid a constitutional confrontation between the executive and legislative branches of government. The highlight of this week's hearings by the Ervin Committee was the appearance of John Mitchell, former Attorney General, former campaign manager for the president's re-election. He conceded that he had put primary importance on that re-election. He was questioned by Senator Talmadge.
I don't understand from your response that you place the expediency of the next election above your responsibility as an intimate to advise the president of the peril that surrounded him. Here was his deputy campaign director involved. Here was his two closest associates in his office involved. All around him were people involved in crime, perjury, accessory after the fact, and you deliberately refused to tell him that. Senator, did you state that the expediency of the election was more important than that?
Senator, I think you've put it exactly correct. In my mind, the re-election of Richard Nixon compared with what was available on the other side was so much more important that I put it in just that context.
15 B-52s came home from Southeast Asia this week, beginning of the end of the bombing in Cambodia, now due to be halted 1 month from today under a presidential congressional compromise. What effect will that have on the Cambodian situation, which continues to deteriorate even with the bombing? Doreen Wu says, not much.
Whether the bombing continues or not is no longer the relevant issue. In the past month, the Cambodian government has steadily lost ground because the Cambodian army is simply too tired and demoralized to fight. The weakness of the army has allowed the insurgents, in spite of the bombing, to push forward. Since the bombing began intensively in February, the radius of insurgent concentration from Phnom Penh has shrunken from 30 to 10 miles. The insurgents have resisted the bombing partly by building bunkers immune to bombing effects. With the war deteriorating on the ground, there is little hope that the air war alone can turn the tide. If the insurgents continue to push, with or without bombing, the Cambodian government is headed for defeat.
The Army's commander of the Pacific, General Frederick Weyand, who presided at the departure of the last American troops from Vietnam, was back this week to assess the situation in Vietnam and Cambodia.
We have come a long, long ways in the days of 1968 and 69 that I'm personally familiar with, and while it isn't the precise ceasefire and peace that we know will come sooner or later, still we have come a long ways, and we've come here with honor.
How much farther do you think you have to go, General? When will peace with honor be achieved?
Well, I'd be the last person to make a forecast like that.
And despite 6 months of an official ceasefire, few would disagree. One of the strangest political sagas of some time unfolded in Argentina this week when Juan Perón's hand-picked elected president resigned after only 49 days in office to be succeeded by a political unknown as an interim president who will serve only long enough to set up elections in which Perón himself can get back into the office from which the military ousted him 18 years ago. There seems no reason to doubt that he will be elected, but how long can he serve? He's an old man now, as Robert Jackney reports.
It was a subdued, tired-looking Juan Perón who appeared on television to explain it all to the Argentine people. If God gives me health, he went on, if God permits, my life will be dedicated to fulfilling any mission the Argentine people want. But Perón's health at age 77, his ability to lead this troubled country, has become a matter of widespread speculation. Still, the old line Peronists, including the resigned president and the acting president, are yielding all to Perón.
Something happened in the city of San Francisco this week. It seemed to climax a civic squabble that erupted a few years ago, but it's also symbolic of what's happening in a lot of places as city fathers attempt to cope with and, in fact, induce change. Norm Woodruff tells us about it.
As the last steel girder was added a few days ago to a new skyscraper here for the Levi Strauss Company, it looked as though the downtown San Francisco building boom was coming to a close. It had started about 6 years ago with a 44-story bank headquarters building suddenly rising in the financial district. Permits were issued for dozens of new buildings of 40 stories and up, including one shaped like a pyramid. Numerous citizens groups sprang up to protest the drastic altering of the San Francisco skyline. Columnist Herb Cain lamented the passing of San Francisco. As a result, the city has now adopted stringent height and bulk rules that limit further high-rise building to specific areas of the city. The mayor, Joseph Alioto, is a high-rise supporter so long as it's limited to the financial district near the ferry building and not along the northern waterfront in the Telegraph Hill Fisherman's Wharf area.
They talk about, some people sometimes compare the Bay of Naples to San Francisco. Let me tell you, the Bay of Naples should be so pretty in connection with that northern viewpoint.
The shouting over high-rise development has generally died out here now. Many of the protesters even like the pyramid today. It's changed the face of the city, no doubt, but San Franciscans have adjusted, but generally hope it's all over now for a few decades. Occasional visitors still are startled, however. As Lowell Thomas told me this weekend as he headed for a short vacation north of here, it's not the same. My, how it's changed.
The World This Week has been produced by Ed Hotelling. I'm Alan Jackson, CBS News.